This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents My Name is Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout. Read for you by Kimberly Farr. There was a time, and it was many years ago now, when I had to stay in a hospital for almost 9 weeks. This was in New York City, and at night, a view of the Chrysler Building, with its geometric brilliance of lights, was directly visible from my bed. During the day, the building's beauty receded, and gradually it became simply one more large structure against a blue sky, and all the city's buildings seemed remote, silent, far away. It was May, and then June, and I remember how I would stand and look out the window at the sidewalk below and watch the young women, my age, in their spring clothes, out on their lunch breaks. I could see their heads moving in conversation, their blouses rippling in the breeze. I thought how, when I got out of the hospital, I would never again walk down the sidewalk without giving thanks for being one of those people. And for many years I did that. I would remember the view from the hospital window and be glad for the sidewalk I was walking on. To begin with, it was a simple story. I had gone into the hospital to have my appendix out. After 2 days, they gave me food, but I couldn't keep it down. And then a fever arrived. No one could isolate any bacteria or figure out what had gone wrong. No one ever did. I took fluids through one IV, and antibiotics came through another. They were attached to a metal pole on wobbly wheels that I pushed around with me, but I got tired easily. Toward the beginning of July, whatever problem had taken hold of me went away. But until then, I was in a very strange state, a literally feverish waiting, and I really agonized. I had a husband and 2 small daughters at home. I missed my girls terribly, and I worried about them so much, I was afraid it was making me sicker. When my doctor, to whom I felt a deep attachment, he was a jowly-faced Jewish man who wore such a gentle sadness on his shoulders, whose grandparents and 3 aunts, I heard him tell a nurse, had been killed in the camps, and who had a wife and 4 grown children here in New York City. This lovely man, I think, felt sorry for me, and saw to it that my girls, they were 5 and 6, could visit me if they had no illnesses. They were brought into my room by a family friend, and I saw how their little faces were dirty, and so was their hair, and I pushed my IV apparatus into the shower with them. But they cried out, "Mommy, you're so skinny!" They were really frightened. They sat with me on the bed while I dried their hair with a towel, and then they drew pictures, but with apprehension, meaning that they did not interrupt themselves every minute by saying, "Mommy, Mommy, do you like this? Mommy, look at the dress of my fairy princess!" They said very little. The younger one especially seemed unable to speak, and when I put my arms around her, I saw her lower lip thrust out and her chin tremble. She was a tiny thing, trying so hard to be brave. When they left, I did not look out the window to watch them walk away with my friend who had brought them, and who had no children of her own. My husband, naturally, was busy running the household, and also busy with his job, and he didn't often have a chance to visit me. He had told me when we met that he hated hospitals. His father had died in one when he was 14. and I saw now that he meant this. In the first room I had been assigned was an old woman dying next to me. She kept calling out for help. It was striking to me how uncaring the nurses were as she cried that she was dying. My husband could not stand it. He could not stand visiting me there, is what I mean. And he had me moved to a single room. Our health insurance didn't cover this luxury, and every day was a drain on our savings. I was grateful not to hear that poor woman crying out. But had anyone known the extent of my loneliness, I would have been embarrassed. Whenever a nurse came to take my temperature, I tried to get her to stay for a few minutes. But the nurses were busy. They could not just hang around talking. About 3 weeks after I was admitted, I turned my eyes from the window late one afternoon and found my mother sitting in a chair at the foot of my bed. "Mom?" I said. "Hi, Lucy," she said. Her voice sounded shy but urgent. She leaned forward and squeezed my foot through the sheet. "Hi, Wizzle," she said. I had not seen my mother for years, and I kept staring at her. I could not figure out why she looked so different. "Mom, how did you get here?" I asked. "Oh, I got on an airplane." She wiggled her fingers, and I knew that there was too much emotion for us. So I waved back and lay flat. "I think you'll be all right," she added, in the same shy-sounding but urgent voice. "I haven't had any dreams." Her being there, using my pet name, which I had not heard in ages, made me feel warm and liquid-filled, as though all my tension had been a solid thing, and now was not. Usually I woke at midnight and dozed fitfully, or stared wide awake through the window at the lights of the city. But that night I slept without waking. And in the morning, my mother was sitting where she had been the day before. "Doesn't matter," she said when I asked. "You know I don't sleep lots." The nurses offered to bring her a cot, but she shook her head. Every time a nurse offered to bring her a cot, she shook her head. After a while, the nurses stopped asking. My mother stayed with me 5 nights, and she never slept but in her chair. During our first full day together, my mother and I talked intermittently. I think neither of us quite knew what to do. She asked me a few questions about my girls, and I answered, with my face becoming hot. "They're amazing," I said. "Oh, they're just amazing." About my husband, my mother asked nothing. Even though he told me this on the telephone, he was the one who had called her and asked her to come be with me, who had paid her airfare, who had offered to pick her up at the airport. My mother, who had never been in an airplane before. In spite of her saying she would take a taxi, in spite of her refusal to see him face to face, my husband had still given her guidance and money to get to me. Now, sitting in a chair at the foot of my bed, my mother also said nothing about my father, and so I said nothing about him either. I kept wishing she would say, "Your father hopes you get better." But she did not. "Was it scary getting a taxi, Mom?" She hesitated, and I felt that I saw the terror that must have visited her when she stepped off the plane. But she said, "I have a tongue in my head, and I used it." After a moment, I said, "I'm really glad you're here." She smiled quickly and looked toward the window. This was the middle of the 1980s, before cell phones, and when the beige telephone next to my bed rang and it was my husband, my mother could tell, I'm sure, by the pitiful way I said, "Hi," as though ready to weep. My mother would quietly rise from her chair and leave the room. I suppose during those times she found food in the cafeteria or called my father from a payphone down the hall, since I never saw her eat, and since I assumed my father wondered over her safety. There was no problem as far as I understood it between them. And after I had spoken to each child, kissing the phone mouthpiece a dozen times, then lying back onto the pillow and closing my eyes, my mother would slip back into the room. For when I opened my eyes, she would be there. That first day we spoke of my brother, the eldest of us three siblings, who, unmarried, lived at home with my parents, though he was 36, and of my older sister, who was 34 and who lived 10 miles from my parents, with 5 children and a husband. I asked if my brother had a job. "He has no job," my mother said. "He spends the night with any animal that will be killed the next day." I asked her what she had said, and she repeated what she had said. She added, "He goes into the Peterson's barn, and he sleeps next to the pigs that will be taken to slaughter." I was surprised to hear this, and I said so, and my mother shrugged. Then my mother and I talked about the nurses. My mother named them right away. Cookie, for the skinny one who was crispy in her affect. Toothache, for the woebegone older one. Serious Child, for the Indian woman we both liked. But I was tired, and so my mother started telling me stories of people she had known years before. She talked in a way I didn't remember, as though a pressure of feeling and words and observations had been stuffed down inside her for years, and her voice was breathy and unselfconscious. Sometimes I dozed off, and when I woke, I would beg her to talk again. But she said, "Oh, Whistledee, you need your rest." "I am resting. Please, Mom. Tell me something. Tell me anything. Tell me about Kathy Nicely. I always loved her name." "Oh, yes. Kathy Nicely. Goodness, she came to a bad end." We were oddities, our family, even in that tiny rural town of Amgash, Illinois, where there were other homes that were run down and lacking fresh paint or shutters or gardens, no beauty for the eye to rest upon. These houses were grouped together in what was the town. But our house was not near them. While it is said that children accept their circumstances as normal, both Vicky and I understood that we were different. We were told on the playground by other children, "Your family stinks," and they'd run off pinching their noses with their fingers. My sister was told by her second grade teacher in front of the class that being poor was no excuse for having dirt behind the ears. No one was too poor to buy a bar of soap. My father worked on farm machinery, though he was often getting fired for disagreeing with the boss, then getting rehired again, I think because he was good at the work and would be needed once more. My mother took in sewing. A hand-painted sign where our long driveway met the road announced sewing and alterations. And though my father, when he said our prayers with us at night, made us thank God that we had enough food, the fact is I was often ravenous, and what we had for supper many nights was molasses on bread. Telling a lie and wasting food were always things to be punished for. Otherwise, on occasion and without warning, my parents, and it was usually my mother, and usually in the presence of our father, struck us impulsively and vigorously, as I think some people may have suspected by our splotchy skin and sullen dispositions. And there was isolation. We lived in the Sauk Valley area, where you can go for a long while seeing only one or two houses surrounded by fields. And, as I have said, we didn't have houses near us. We lived with cornfields and fields of soybeans spreading to the horizon. And yet, beyond the horizon was the Petersons' pig farm. In the middle of the cornfields stood one tree, and its starkness was striking. For many years, I thought that tree was my friend. It was my friend. Our home was down a very long dirt road, not far from the Rock River, near some trees that were windbreaks for the cornfields. So we did not have any neighbors nearby. And we did not have a television. And we did not have newspapers or magazines or books in the house. The first year of her marriage, my mother had worked at the local library and apparently, my brother later told me this, loved books. But then the library told my mother the regulations had changed. They could only hire someone with a proper education. My mother never believed them. She stopped reading, and many years went by before she went to a different library in a different town and brought home books again. I mention this because there is the question of how children become aware of what the world is and how to act in it. How, for example, do you learn that it is impolite to ask a couple why they have no children? How do you set a table? How do you know if you are chewing with your mouth open if no one has ever told you? How do you even know what you look like if the only mirror in the house is a tiny one high above the kitchen sink? Or if you have never heard a living soul say that you are pretty, but rather, as your breasts develop, are told by your mother that you are starting to look like one of the cows in the Petersons' barn? How Vicky managed, to this day I don't know. We were not as close as you might expect. We were equally friendless and equally scorned, and we eyed each other with the same suspicion with which we eyed the rest of the world. There are times now, and my life has changed so completely, that I think back on the early years, and I find myself thinking, it was not that bad. Perhaps it was not. But there are times, too, unexpected, when walking down a sunny sidewalk, or watching the top of a tree bend in the wind, or seeing a November sky close down over the East River, I am suddenly filled with the knowledge of darkness so deep that a sound might escape from my mouth, and I will step into the nearest clothing store and talk with a stranger about the shape of sweaters newly arrived. This must be the way most of us maneuver through the world, half knowing, half not, visited by memories that can't possibly be true. But when I see others walking with confidence down the sidewalk, as though they are free completely from terror, I realize I don't know how others are. So much of life seems speculation. The thing about Kathy, my mother said. The thing about Kathy was. My mother leaned forward in her chair and tilted her head with her hand to her chin. Gradually, I saw how, in the years since I had last known her, she had gained just enough weight to cause her features to soften. Her glasses were no longer black but beige, and the hair beside her face had turned paler, but not gray, so she seemed a slightly larger, fuzzier version of her younger self. The thing about Kathy, I said, is that she was nice. I don't know, my mother said. I don't know how nice she was. We were interrupted by the nurse, Cookie, who walked into the room with her clipboard, then held my wrist and took my pulse, gazing into the air, her blue eyes far away. She took my temperature, glanced at the thermometer, wrote something on my chart, and walked out of the room. My mother, who had been watching Cookie, now gazed out the window. Kathy Nicely always wanted more. I often thought the reason she was friends with me, oh, I don't know if you could call us friends, really. I just sewed for her and she paid me. But I've often thought the reason she would stay and talk, well, she did have me over to her place when her troubles arrived. But what I'm trying to say here is that I always thought she liked my circumstances being so much lower than her own. She couldn't envy anything about me. Kathy always wanted something she didn't have. She had those beautiful daughters, but they weren't enough. She wanted a son. She had that nice house in Hanston, but it wasn't nice enough. She wanted something closer to a city. What city? That's how she was. And then, plucking something from her lap, squinting, my mother added in a lower voice, "She was an only child. I think that had something to do with it, how self-centered they can be." I felt the cold, hot shock that comes from being struck without warning. My husband was an only child, and my mother had told me long before that such a condition, as she put it, could only lead to selfishness in the end. My mother went on. Well, she was jealous. Not of me, of course. But, for example, Kathy wanted to travel, and her husband wasn't like that. He wanted Kathy to be content and stay at home, and they would live off his salary. He did well. He managed a farm of feed corn, you know. They had a perfectly nice life. Anyone would have wanted their life, really. Why, they went to dances at some club. I've not been to a dance since high school. Kathy would come to me and get a new dress made just to go to a dance. Sometimes she brought the girls over, such pretty little things and well-behaved. I always remember the first time she brought them over. Kathy said to me, "May I present the pretty, nicely girls?" And when I started to say, "Oh, they're lovely indeed," she said, "No, that's what they're called at their school in Hanston, the pretty, nicely girls." Now, how does that feel, I've always wondered, to be known as a pretty, nicely girl? "Though once," my mother said in her urgent voice, "I caught one of them whispering to her sister something about our place smelling funny." "That's just kids, Mom," I said. "Kids always think places smell funny." My mother took her glasses off, breathed on each lens briskly, and cleaned them with the cloth of her skirt. I thought how naked her face looked then. I could not stop staring at her naked-looking face. And then, one day, you know, the times changed. People think everyone went foolish in the 60s, but it wasn't until the 70s, really. Her glasses returned. Her face returned. My mother continued. Or maybe it took that long for the changes to find their way to our cow patch. But one day, Kathy came to visit, and she was giggly and strange, girlish, you know. You'd gone off by then, to... My mother raised her arm and wiggled her fingers. She did not say school. She did not say college. And so I didn't say those words either. My mother said, Kathy fancied someone she'd met. That was clear to me, though she didn't come out and say so. I had a vision, a visitation, it would be more accurate to say. It came to me as I sat there looking at her. And I saw this, and I thought, uh-oh, Kathy's in trouble. And she was, I said. And she was. Kathy Nicely had fallen in love with the teacher of one of her children, who were all three in high school by this time, and she began to see this man secretly. Then she told her husband that she had to realize herself more fully, and she couldn't do it trapped by domestic chains. So she moved out, left her husband, her daughters, her house. It wasn't until she called my mother weeping that my mother learned the details. My mother drove to find her. Kathy had rented a small apartment, and she was sitting on a beanbag chair, much skinnier than she used to be, and she confessed to my mother that she had fallen in love, but once she'd moved out of her house, the fellow had dropped her, said he could not continue with what they'd been doing. My mother, having come to this point in the story, raised her eyebrows, as though the puzzlement of this was large but not unpleasant to her. Anyway, her husband was furious and humiliated and would not take her back. Her husband never took her back. He went for over 10 years without even speaking to her. When the oldest girl, Linda, got married straight out of high school, Kathy invited my parents to the wedding because, my mother surmised, Kathy had no one at the wedding who would speak to her. That girl got married so quickly, my mother said, speaking rapidly now. People thought she was pregnant. But no child arrived that I ever heard about, and she divorced him a year later and went off to Beloit, I believe, looking for a rich husband, and I think I heard she found one. My mother said that at the wedding, Kathy kept flitting around, desperately nervous. It was a sad thing to see. Of course, we didn't know a soul, and it was obvious she'd just about hired us to be there. We sat in the chairs. I remember on one wall of the place, you know, it was the club, that silly, fancy place in Hanston, and they had all these Indian arrowheads under glass. Why was that, I wondered? Who would care about all those arrowheads? And Kathy would try and talk to some person and then come right back to us. Even Linda, gussied up in white, and Kathy had not asked me to make the gown. The girl went out and bought it. Even this bride girl hardly gave her mother the time of day. Kathy's lived in a little house a few miles from her husband, ex-husband now, for almost 15 years. All alone. The girls stayed loyal to their father. I'm surprised, when I think of it, that Kathy was even allowed at the wedding. Anyway, he never had anyone else. He should have taken her back, I said, tears in my eyes. I suppose his pride was hurt. My mother shrugged. Well, he's alone now. And she's alone, and one day they're going to die. True, my mother said. I became distraught that day over the fate of Kathy Nicely, while my mother sat at the foot of my bed. At least I remember it that way. I know that I told my mother, with a lump in my throat and my eyes stinging, that Kathy's husband should have taken her back. I'm quite sure I said, "He'll be sorry. I'm telling you, he will." And my mother said, "I suspect she's the one who's sorry." But maybe that wasn't what my mother said. Until I was 11 years old, we lived in a garage. The garage belonged to my great uncle, who lived in the house next door. And in the garage, there was only a trickle of cold water from a makeshift sink. Insulation, nailed against the wall, held a stuffing like pink cotton candy. But it was fiberglass and could cut us, we were told. I was puzzled by that and would stare at it often. Such a pretty pink thing I could not touch. And I was puzzled to think it was called glass. Odd to think now how much time it seemed to take up in my head, the puzzle of that pretty, pink, and dangerous fiberglass we lived right next to every minute. My sister and I slept on canvas cots that were bunk beds, metal poles holding one on top of the other. My parents slept beneath the one window, which looked out over the expanse of cornfields, and my brother had a cot in the far corner. At night, I would listen to the humming noise of the little refrigerator. It would go on and off. Some nights moonlight came through the window. Other nights it was very dark. In the winter it was cold enough that often I could not sleep. And sometimes my mother heated water on the burner and poured it into the red rubber hot water bottle and let me sleep with that. When my great uncle died, we moved into the house, and we had hot water and a flush toilet, though in the winter the house was very cold. Always I have hated being cold. There are elements that determine paths taken, and we can seldom find them or point to them accurately. But I have sometimes thought how I would stay late at school where it was warm, just to be warm. The janitor, with a silent nod and such a kind expression on his face, always let me into a classroom where the radiators were still hissing. And so I did my homework there. Often I might hear the faint echo in the gym of the cheerleaders practicing, or the bouncing of a basketball, or perhaps in the music room the band would be practicing too. But I remained alone in the classroom, warm. And that was when I learned that work gets done if you simply do it. I could see the logic of my homework assignments in a way I could not if I did my work at home. And when my homework was finished, I read, until I finally had to leave. Our elementary school was not big enough to have a library, but there were books in the classrooms that we could take home and read. In third grade, I read a book that made me want to write a book. This book was about two girls, and they had a nice mother, and they went to stay in a different town for the summer, and they were happy girls. In this new town, there was a girl named Tilly. Tilly, who was strange and unattractive because she was dirty and poor, and the girls were not nice to Tilly, but the nice mother made them be good to her. This is what I remember from the book. Tilly. My teacher saw that I loved reading, and she gave me books, even grown-up books, and I read them. And then later in high school, I still read books when my homework was done in the warm school. But the books brought me things. This is my point. They made me feel less alone. This is my point, and I thought, I will write, and people will not feel so alone. But it was my secret. Even when I met my husband, I didn't tell him right away. I couldn't take myself seriously. Except that I did. I took myself secretly, secretly, very seriously. I knew I was a writer. I didn't know how hard it would be, but no one knows that, and that does not matter. Because of the hours I stayed in the warm classroom, because of the reading I did, and because I saw that if you didn't miss a piece of the work, the homework made sense. Because of these things, my grades became perfect. My senior year, the guidance counselor called me to her office and said that a college just outside of Chicago was inviting me to attend with all expenses paid. My parents did not say much about this, probably out of defense for my brother and sister, who had not had perfect or even particularly good grades. Neither one went on to school. It was the guidance counselor who drove me to the college on a blistering hot day. Oh, I loved that place, immediately, silently, breathlessly. It seemed huge to me. Buildings everywhere, the lake absolutely enormous to my eyes. People strolling, moving in and out of classrooms. I was terrified, but not as much as I was excited. I learned rapidly to imitate people, to try to have the gaps in my knowledge about popular culture be unnoticed, although it was not easy, that part. But I remember this. When I came home for Thanksgiving, I could not fall asleep that night, and it was because I was afraid I had dreamed my life at the college. I was afraid that I would wake and find myself once more in this house, and I would be in this house forever. And it seemed unbearable to me. I thought, no! I kept thinking that for a long time, until I fell asleep. Near the college, I got a job, and I bought clothes in a thrift shop. It was the mid-70s, and clothes like that were acceptable, even if you were not poor. To my knowledge, no one spoke of how I dressed. But once, before I met my husband, I fell very much in love with a professor, and we had a brief affair. He was an artist, and I liked his work, though I understood that I did not understand it. But it was him I loved. His harshness, his intelligence, his awareness that certain things had to be foregone if he was to have the life he could have. Like children, they were foregone. But I record this now for one purpose alone. He was the only person I remember from my youth as mentioning my clothes, and he mentioned them by comparing me to a woman professor in his department who dressed expensively and was physically large, as I was not. He said, "You have more substance, but Irene has more style." I said, "But style is substance." I didn't know yet that such a thing was true. I had simply written it down one day in my Shakespeare class because the Shakespeare professor had said it, and I thought it sounded true. The artist replied, "In that case, Irene has more substance." I was slightly embarrassed for him, that he would think of me as having no style because the clothes I wore were me, and if they came from thrift shops and were not ordinary outfits, it did not occur to me that this would mean anything, except to someone rather shallow. And then he mentioned one day,
"Do you like this shirt? I got this shirt at Bloomingdale's once when I was in New York. I'm always impressed with that fact whenever I put it on."
And again, I felt embarrassed, because he seemed to think this mattered, and I had thought he was deeper than that, smarter than that. He was an artist. I loved him very much. He must have been the first person I remember as wondering about my social class, though at the time I would not have even had words for that, because he would drive me around neighborhoods and say, "Is your house like that?" And the houses he pointed to were never like any house familiar to me. They were not large houses. They just weren't at all like the garage I grew up in, which I had told him about. And they were not like my great-uncle's house, either. I was not sorry about the fact of that garage. Not in the way I think he meant me to be. But he seemed to think I would be sorry. Still, I loved him. He asked what we ate when I was growing up. I did not say, "Mostly molasses on bread." I did say, "We had baked beans a lot." And he said,
"What did you do after that? All hang around and fart?"
Then I understood I would never marry him. It's funny how one thing can make you realize something like that. One can be ready to give up the children one always wanted. One can be ready to withstand remarks about one's past or one's clothes. But then a tiny remark, and the soul deflates and says, "Oh." I have since been friends with many men and women, and they say the same thing. Always that telling detail. What I mean is, this is not just a woman's story. It's what happens to a lot of us, if we are lucky enough to hear that detail and pay attention to it. Looking back, I imagine that I was very odd, that I spoke too loudly or that I said nothing when things of popular culture were mentioned. I think I responded strangely to ordinary types of humor that were unknown to me. I think I didn't understand the concept of irony at all, and that confused people. When I first met my husband, William, I felt, and it was a surprise, that he really did understand something in me. He was the lab assistant to my biology professor my sophomore year, and had his own solitary view of the world. My husband was from Massachusetts, and he was the son of a German prisoner of war who had been sent to work the potato fields of Maine. Half-starved, as they often were, this man had won the heart of a farmer's wife, and when he returned to Germany after the war, he thought about her and wrote her and told her he was disgusted with Germany and all they had done. He returned to Maine and ran off with this farmer's wife, and they went to Massachusetts, where he trained to become a civil engineer. Their marriage, naturally, cost the wife a great deal. My husband had the blonde German looks I saw from photos of his father. His father spoke German a great deal when William was growing up. Though, when William was 14, his father died. No letters remain between William's father and mother. Whether his father really felt disgust for Germany, I don't know. William believed he did. And so, for many years, I believed that too. William, running from the neediness of his widowed mother, went to school in the Midwest. But when I met him, he was already eager to get back east as soon as he could. Still, he wanted to meet my parents. This was his idea, that we would go together to Amgash, and he would explain to them how we were going to be married and move to New York City, where he had a postdoctoral appointment waiting for him at a university. In truth, it had not occurred to me to worry. I had no concept of turning my back on anything. I was in love, and life was moving forward, and that felt natural. We drove past acres of soybeans and corn. It was early June, and the soybeans were on one side, a sharp green, lighting up the slighting, sloping fields with their beauty. And on the other side was the corn, not yet as high as my knees, a bright green that would darken in the coming weeks, the leaves supple now, then becoming stronger. Oh, corn of my youth, you were my friend, running and running between the rows, running as only a child alone in summer can run, running to that stark tree that stood in the midst of the cornfield. In my memory, the sky was gray as we drove, and it appeared to rise, not clear, but rise. And it was very beautiful. The sense of it rising and growing lighter, the gray having the slightest touch of blue, the trees full with their green leaves. I remember my husband saying he had not expected my house to be so small. We did not stay with my parents an entire day. My father was wearing his mechanic's coveralls, and he looked at William, and when they shook hands, I saw in my father's face great contortions, the kind that frequently preceded what, as a child, I had called, to myself, the thing, meaning an incident of my father becoming very anxious and not in control of himself. After that, I think that my father did not look at William again, but I can't be sure. William offered to take my parents and my brother and sister into town to eat dinner at some place of their choice. My face felt as hot as the sun when he said that. We had never once eaten in a restaurant as a family. My father told him, "Your money is no good here." And William looked at me with an expression of confusion, and I gave my head a tiny shake. I murmured that we should leave. My mother walked out to where I was standing alone by the car and said, "Your father has a lot of trouble with German people. You should have told us." "Told you?" "You know your father was in the war, and some German men tried to kill him. He's been having a terrible time from the moment he saw William." "I know Daddy was in the war," I said, "but he never talked about any of that." "There are two kinds of men when it comes to their war experience," my mother said. "One talks of it, one doesn't. Your father belongs to the group who doesn't." "And why is that?" "Because it wouldn't be decent," my mother said, adding, "Who in God's name brought you up?" It was not until many years later, long after, that I learned from my brother how my father, in a German town, had come upon two young men who startled him, and my father had shot them in the back. He did not think they were soldiers. They were not dressed like soldiers. But he had shot them, and when he kicked one over, he saw how young he was. My brother told me that William had seemed to my father an older version of this person, a young man who had come back to taunt him, to take away his daughter. My father had murdered two German boys, and as my father lay dying, he told my brother that not a day had gone by when he did not think of them and feel that he should have taken his own life in exchange. What else happened to my father in the war, I do not know. But he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was at the Hürtgen Forest, and these were two of the worst places to be in the war. My family did not attend my wedding or acknowledge it.
But when my first daughter was born, I called my parents from New York. And my mother said she had dreamed it, so she already knew I had a baby girl. But she didn't know the name, and she seemed pleased with the name, Christina. After that, I called them on their birthdays and on holidays, and when my other daughter, Becca, was born. We spoke politely, but always I felt with discomfort. And I did not see any of my family until the day my mother showed up at the foot of my bed in the hospital, where the Chrysler Building shone outside the window. In the dark, I asked my mother quietly if she was awake. "Oh, yes," she answered, quietly. Even though it was only the two of us in this hospital room with the Chrysler Building shining at the window, we still whispered as though someone could be disturbed. "Why do you think the guy Kathy fell in love with said he couldn't go ahead with it once she left her husband? Did he get scared?" After a moment, my mother said, "I don't know. But Kathy told me he'd confessed to her he was a homo." "Gay?" I sat up and saw her at the foot of my bed. "He told her he was gay?" "I suppose that's what you call it now. Back then, we said homo. He said homo. Or Kathy said it. I don't know who said homo, but he was one."
"Mom, oh, Mom, you're making me laugh."
And I could hear she'd started laughing herself, though she said, "Wizzle, I don't really know what's so funny."
"You are."
Tears of laughter seeped from my eyes.
"The story is, that's a terrible story."
Still laughing, in the same suppressed yet urgent way her talking had been during the day, she said, "I'm not sure what's funny about leaving your husband for a homo gay person and then finding it out when you think you're going to have a whole man."
"Killing me, Mom."
I lay back down. My mother said musingly, "I sometimes thought maybe he wasn't gay. That Kathy scared him, leaving her life behind for him. That maybe he made it up." I considered this. Back then, I don't know if that's the kind of thing a man would make up about himself.
"Oh," said my mother. "Oh, I guess that's true. I honestly don't know about Kathy's fellow. I don't know if he's still around or anything about him at all."
"But did they do it?"
"I don't know," my mother answered. "How would I know? Do what? Have intercourse? How in the world would I know?"
"They must have had intercourse," I said, because I thought it was funny saying that, and also because I believed it.
"You don't run out on three girls and a husband for a crush."
"Maybe you do."
"Okay, maybe you do,"
I asked then. "And Kathy's husband, Mr. Nicely, he really hasn't had anyone since?"
"Ex-husband. Divorced her quick as a bunny. Anyway, I don't believe so. There seems no indication of such a thing, but I suppose you never know."
Maybe it was the darkness, with only the pale crack of light that came through the door, the constellation of the magnificent Chrysler Building right beyond us, that allowed us to speak in ways we never had.
"People," I said.
"People," my mother said.
I was so happy. Oh, I was happy speaking with my mother this way.
In those days, and it was the mid-80s, as I have said, William and I lived in the West Village, in a small apartment near the river. a walk-up, and it was something. With the two small children and having no laundry facilities in the building, and we also had a dog. I would put the younger child in a carry pack on my back until she got too big, and walk the dog, bending precariously to pick up his mess in a plastic bag as the signs told one to do, clean up after your dog. Always calling out to my older girl to wait for me, not to step off the sidewalk. Wait. Wait. I had two friends, and I was half in love with one of them, Jeremy. He lived on the top floor of our building, and he was almost, but not quite, the age of my father. He had come originally from France, from the aristocracy, and he gave that all up to be in America, starting as a young man. "Everyone different wanted to be in New York back then," he told me. "It was the place to come to. I guess it still is." Jeremy had decided in the middle of his life to become a psychoanalyst, and when I met him he still had a few patients, but he would not talk to me about what that was like. He had an office across from the new school, and three times a week he went there. I would pass him on the street, and the sight of him, tall, thin, dark-haired, wearing a dark suit, and his soulful face, always made my heart rise. "Jeremy," I would say, and he would smile and lift his hat in a way that was courtly and old-fashioned and European. This is how I saw it. His apartment I had seen only once, and this was when I got locked out and had to wait for the super to show up. Jeremy found me on the front stoop with the dog and both children, and I was frantic, and he had me come in. The children were immediately quiet and very well behaved once we got inside his place, as though they knew no children were ever there. And in fact, I had never seen children going into Jeremy's apartment. Only a man or two, or sometimes a woman. The apartment was clean and spare. A stalk of purple iris was in a glass vase against a white wall, and there was art on the walls that made me understand then how far apart he and I were. I say this because I didn't understand the art. They were dark and oblong pieces, almost abstract but not quite constructions, and I understood only that they were symptoms of a sophisticated world I could never understand. Jeremy was uncomfortable having my family in his place, I could sense that, but he was an exquisite gentleman, and this was why I loved him so. Three things about Jeremy. I was standing one day on the front stoop, and as he came out of the building, I said, "Jeremy, sometimes when I stand here, I can't believe I'm really in New York City. I stand here and think, whoever would have guessed? Me! I'm living in the city of New York." And a look went across his face, so fast, so involuntary, that was a look of real distaste. I had not yet learned the depth of disgust city people feel for the truly provincial. The second thing about Jeremy, I had my first story published right after I moved to New York, and then it was a while, and my second story was published. On the steps one day, Chrissy told this to Jeremy. "Mommy got a story in a magazine!" He turned to look at me. He looked at me deeply. I had to look away. "No, no," I said. "Just a silly little, really small literary magazine." He said, "So you're a writer. You're an artist. I work with artists. I know. I guess I've always known that about you." I shook my head.
I thought of the artist from college, his knowledge of himself, his ability to forego children. Jeremy sat down beside